Yes, indeed. That's Connor Listoka performing live at the if only. Hey, everyone, this is 372 Pages. We'll Never Get Back. Mike Nelson here and
Connor Listoka. Yeah, the last time I heard that song, it was being obscured by the cheers of the crowds that were responding so well to the live remixed version of the 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back theme song.
Oh, the wave was going up in the tiny club of Sisyphus Brewing, and people were going nuts. That was the first time in a podcast, I think, that security had to step in with, pulling people off the stage and keys hitting you in the face.
And if you don't believe that, you have no proof that it didn't happen.
So. That is correct. Why are we here, Connor?
Well, so we did a show last week, Mike. It was very fun. It was very well received. I had a blast. We promised people we'd put it up the next day, and then it got bumped back to the next Monday. And then people started, taking out the pitchforks. And that's when it came to our attention that the show had, in fact, not been recorded at all.
Yeah, let me pull out an old phrase from, 1973. Mistakes were made. As the Nixonian phrase goes. The thing was not recorded. Whether or not that's a good thing, we leave it to you. We want this to become a legendary unreleased recording.
Yeah, it'll be like our clown who cried.
Yes.
That'll be the...
I just was reading about Sid Barrett. Don't ask me why. It was a rabbit trail on the internet. One of the founders of Pink Floyd, mm-hmm. who... reclusively went to his mom's house in Cambridge or something and then came out for a couple concerts. And the people who were there described them as, these mystical events. And then others were like, he was too drunk to play. So it's out there. Nobody knows. It was either the best thing in the world or the worst. And there's no way to tell.
He's the guy that once you're, a high school kid and you've listened to all the good Pink Floyd, like the really, the classic stuff that sold tens of millions of copies, then you start to read about people who are like, the real stuff is this stuff with Sid Barrett that you listen to and you're like, okay. It's like, these are not the same bands. What are you even doing here?
All right. Well, so on stage, we won't dwell on what we did on stage, but we're going to go through this again because we watched the movie. We both watched it twice, right? You didn't see it three times, did you?
No, I didn't go back and see it yesterday once we decided to do this again.
No, I thought not, but I thought, you're a thorough person. Maybe you want to refresh your memories. But no, it's pretty fresh with me having seen it twice. And Connor and I talked about on stage that we the quest to see it, because he got into town and we had to see it that day and then do the podcast on it in the evening, drove to a total of three theaters and got one showing out of the three theaters.
It was a nice little tour of suburban Minneapolis. I felt like I was in a Hold Steady song.
You saw a lot of places that make artisan popcorn and Cold Stone creameries and pretty decent parking lots sort of filled with gross melting snow. And so,
there was an abnormally high number of centers that will process the payroll for health insurance committees, that sort of thing.
Minneapolis at its finest. But we went through the movie, and that's what we're going to do now. But I don't want this to seem like, this is a good thing. There's a lot of fun stuff in here. And later on, we're going to have you, the audience. Are you an audience when you're listening to a podcast? I don't know how that works.
Yeah, an audience of one. That's a thing.
Right. Play the game that we played on stage, which is guess whether the review line that Connor has picked out from the reviews of the film is a rotten or fresh review.
And that was this movie got a 74% Rotten Tomato rating, which is very good. But as we discussed, we don't think that the movie was very good, so that was surprising to us. So I pulled out some of the quotes from those reviews, and we can we'll go through those a bit later. But yeah, so did you? We didn't think that the movie was very good. We went in with an open mind. We didn't like the book, but perhaps it's got a pro behind the camera, and they could have translated some of these more visual, goofy things into a more cinematic vision. But
yeah, I thought that I guess it was a fear, if you can call it a fear of mine, that Spielberg would somehow pluck out some you know, a bit of heart or sentiment at the middle of it and make that the driving thing and sort of, you know, cull away a lot of the, you know, a lot of the stuff that people loved about it, the dwelling on the 80s pop culture. But, you know, I'm sure that would be an element, but he would have a through line that was really sort of neat and tidy about, you know, a guy trying to accomplish something that would change him. You know, classic, right. Classic stuff, the poetics, right? That did not happen. He did not
know.
This is an indulgent film that just lards on the stuff in a curious way. Like, he didn't follow the book. The book was not a, you know, an untouchable tome. It was just a you know, when you go, what did you call it locally when you take every soda on the soda stream and just put it in a big cup and shake it up? And
oh, yeah, we called it a suicide, which is probably not allowed anymore.
I think we call it a garbage can. But yeah, this movie's a garbage can of pop culture with, I mean, the plot in the middle of it, I honestly still have major questions about what was going on there.
Right.
So no, yeah, I didn't like it.
It did diverge from the book, which is a phenomenon I encountered, was that there is a subset of people out there who are do not like the movie. So they have the right opinion. It wasn't very good, but their opinion is based on the fact that they don't like it because it diverged so wildly from the holy writ of the book. So their opinion is good, but it's based on a terrible fact, or it's based on a reality that is false. So that's, right. That's been a fun thing to sort of observe. Like, I love the book and this movie was garbage.
Well, I don't know. In this case, is it the enemy of my enemy is my friend? Do we align with those people? It's tough to do because we don't like the book either.
I pulled a quote from one of those guys, just a random Reddit user. My biggest issue with the film was the lack of care that was put into writing, directing, and character dialogue. There seemed to be an incredible amount of attention to detail when it came to what I was looking at, but the writing and dialogue felt very lazy and sloppy to me. Keeping going. Anyway, I won't get into my criticism of the film, as it was just a fun, dumb movie for me. Whereas the book, I think, is great. If I ever consume RP1 again in the future, it will always be the book, because Ready Player One for me was an example of the book being better by a lot.
Wow. He is out on the edge there on that one. I mean, I get his not liking a film based on the fact that the dialogue, characters, plot, and everything were kind of crappy.
Yes.
You're spot on there. That's my criteria as well.
But to say that that is unlike the book, which presented the rich universe of dialogue and chat links and arguing about Star Wars is a misguided at best.
Oh, my.
Anyway.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go through our we have some issues with the film, and hopefully this is still – the film is still fresh enough in everyone's mind out there that this will make sense.
Yeah, I mean, so the film was successful to a point. It's it sort of seems like right after it was number one at the box office, and it probably, you know, earned enough money that to, you know, cement that it was a success and that you can make this guy's books into future movies. But then the next movie that came out was John Krasinski's Quiet Place, which made pretty much the exact same amount of money. And I had literally not seen anything about that movie until it was, you know, being reviewed at the box office. Whereas Ready Player One had, you know, expensive campaigns and a cover of Entertainment Weekly and a, you know, HQ trivia game and all this merch and stuff. So it seems like that was sort of a, I don't know if your bang for the buck was worth it in that department. But it wasn't like, this is not a Black Panther or a Lord of the Rings kind of success. So you can take a minor solace in that.
Yeah, where did it end up? Did you check box office today? Because we're now on the – I'm assuming it's tailing off severely at this point.
A guy already sent a picture of the Gunter merchandise, like a Gunter Life t-shirt that he said is being marked down already, like you know, 50% off type of thing.
And how many did you buy and in what sizes?
I'm waiting till they hit the dollar bin. But yeah, it's like it is you know, the second highest movie of the year because Black Panther came out. It's made the same amount of money as Peter Rabbit, and Quiet Place will probably be equivalent to that this year. So, you know, it's like probably a success, but it's not as bad as you would have hoped, and it's not as good as you would have feared. So,
right. Peter Rabbit, I wonder what that Rotten Tomato score is on that, because all I heard was just people going like, this is a loathsome, annoying film.
And, oh, wow.
You know, take your kids at your own risk, but, you know, bring a game or something.
I assume the rabbit raps at some point in time, though.
I thought that would be half the movie, yeah.
Right. Sex scene with Mrs. Tiggy Winkle was shocking to me.
Oh, hey.
But yeah, let's get into it. The movie starts in the stacks, which is the location, the trailer parks all stacked on top of each other that was clearly designed just to be a cinematic setting. The camera sort of sweeps into that, and Van Halen's Jump starts playing, which the first time I saw in the theater, you know, the first three synth notes kick in, and the guys in the row behind me just go, "Oh, hell yeah," which was a sign that, you know, perhaps there is a target audience for this type of thing. If that, if one of the most overplayed and overused songs from the past 30 years excites you at this point in time, I guess you're probably going to like what this movie is offering up.
Yeah, but it accurately set the scene in 2045 when Jump was topping the charts.
But it sort of sweeps through the stacks where, you know, the life is going pretty good. There's like dads barbecuing for their family. There's a Pizza Hut pizza being delivered by drone. People are out and, like, you know, pouring like gardening and stuff. So it's a, you know, it's a sort of relatively squalid setting, but it's
yeah, but
no,
it
one's
doesn't
feasting on other humans or anything.
Right. Yeah, there's no you know, dogs are not like taking babies away out of it. It you know, it looks like a like a fun neighborhood to be in, I guess, except for the vertical nature of it, which doesn't make any sense. I'm pretty sure that, I mean, they don't give us any view of the landscape, but Ohio has a lot of room to spread east and west rather than going up and down. So the stacks are dubious at best, but like you say, they're just a, that seems to be, for some reason, people have keyed on that as like his brilliant point in the book that, wow, we've gotten to this point where we have to stack our trailers. But as it turns out, that is not at all true. Everything's going well.
Yeah, even more so, I feel like, than the book, where we constantly harped on that point. It seems like things are going fine. He says that Columbus is the fastest growing city, but he does mention that there have been bandwidth riots and corn syrup droughts in the future, which are sort of a jokey kind of thing. But, you know, the bandwidth riots are another just example of the phantom omnipresent threat of lag looming over the entire book. The fact that you might be able to not jack into the Oasis without encountering some stuttering as you decide that you're going to assume the form of one of the guys from Double Dragon is just a haunting specter.
Yeah, I also thought that the tone of that joke is weird, that look, is this a serious world or not? Are things going poorly? Oh, corn syrup droughts. Ha ha ha. So they're not. So I'm not invested. So forget it. All right. If you guys aren't taking it seriously, then neither am I.
Yeah. We pan through the world, and we were consistently seeing Doritos. He's got Chinese takeout containers and the sort of black takeout containers with the plastic top that you see in his apartment. So those businesses are existing as well. You can still get chicken cashew and beef broccoli takeout. So the corn syrup droughts didn't have any effect on that.
No.
But yeah, so he sort of walks us through the world of the Oasis, and it's a chance to show off some stuff that you're never really going to see again. You know, unicorn polo and other casino planets types of things. And it sort of focuses in on the fact that you might be killed and zero out, lose all the things that you've worked for. It shows a Asian businessman who has been zeroed out and takes the opportunity to try to jump out the window of his office building, which is, as Klein would call it, would be committing seppuku. Because any form of suicide evidently was seppuku in Klein's world.
Which so was, I would also point out, that is a jokey moment. Like, this guy is actually going to, so again, he's in a high rise building that seems to be doing pretty well. And then, I don't know, it just seemed a little odd that they used the Japanese guy, like, you know, and, oh, you know how they are. They're going to jump out windows and because they didn't do well.
Because he lost his bag of holding or something.
Yeah. Anyway, that was an odd joke, again, to set the tone for a apocalyptic world, a post-apocalyptic world, to have this little, ha-ha, that guy was going to kill himself.
Right.
But there we are.
Yeah. So it introduces us to the guy behind this whole thing, you know, which is Halliday. And it shows him as portrayed by Oscar nominee winner Mark Rylance from other Spielberg movies. And he was in Dunkirk. But he's portraying Halliday, which you pointed out as we were watching the movie, is the is a business visionary in mom jeans.
Yes. They love that. They dress him up, and I don't know what are they trying to say with this guy. He's obviously socially awkward. In the book, he's a flat out psycho. I mean,
yeah,
he's a, I would say, touching on evil almost.
Right. Yeah. He's firing people in the book for not understanding his references and shrieking and having a weird laugh. In this book, he's obviously just sort of a gentle nerd. But to me, it felt, you know, it was very close to a character that Robert Downey Jr.'s character in Tropic Thunder would have some issues with in terms of the way that he was portraying this. And I've seen this character praised as the high point of the film, this performance. And I felt like he was just laying it on really, really thick in terms of the what he was trying to do, like sort of stuttering over his things and not making eye contact type of thing.
Let's just say he didn't go full, but it's definitely close, and it's a little bit disturbing because we all know socially awkward people, and I think you pointed out, like, Bill Gates, we understand that he's kind of got, you know, unkempt hair and glasses, and he doesn't wear a bespoke suit and everything, but otherwise he functions as a human being.
Yes, yeah.
You can understand. It's like, I guess he looks like he might have been a nerd back in the day.
Right.
But, he runs a multi-billion-dollar company. It seems okay.
All right. I guess we did just see, I didn't see. I saw a lot of people making fun of Mark Zuckerberg. So maybe that was a similar type of thing. That was a story that I did not click on a single link, but I saw a lot of people having fun at his expense. So maybe that was a Halliday-esque performance in front of the Senate.
Right.
So he introduces that world. Halliday dies. He leaves everything to everybody, which makes 8-year-old girls cry when they're watching it on their iPads in school. But then they sort of introduce the first challenge sort of right off the bat. They jump into it. They say that the first challenge was discovered by a long forgotten Gunter, which I took as a gigantic slap in the face to Pendergast.
This will not stand. This is where I go online and type 10,000 words saying, how dare you, sir, leave this out.
Pull you back to your seat as you were trying to walk out of the theater. Like, you're making a scene. Like, please, like, just, yeah, register your disgust online. We got to finish watching the movie.
A note from our live show. We did it at the Sisyphus Brewing, as we've mentioned many times, and they renamed one of their lagers, the Pendergast Lager. Wasn't maybe quite the hit that we expected. It was a mixed crowd there, but let's just say that there was no high fives over the, hey, nice rename on the beer.
Yeah, we sort of took we paused after that. We're like, yeah, this is a real slap in the face to Pendergast, anybody? And there's like a half-hearted, like, woo, yeah. The brewery puts the out of business sign up for the very next day.
Oh, I love that.
There was a couple of those that night, too. We'll get to them later, probably. But,
oh, we will.
So they go straight to this race, which is a big this sort of video game burnout style race where you're trying to get to a finish line. There's no real problem solving or anything like that. It's just a big game of a racing game that they've been doing every day for 5 years. So our hero is in the world. He needs to sort of go to the back of the line because he doesn't have any money for gas. But we get introduced to H. We see all the Sixers driving their generic cars, and it's the first time we see Artemis. And there was something here that happened as they're racing. It's, you know, it's impressive. I could tell what was going on. It's not something that I need to be too excited about, because set pieces like this are in every single movie that comes out.
And I would say, you know, props to the Fast and the Furious. They use real cars. They still do that. Those scenes, for what it's worth, it's not my cup of tea, not the movies I go to see, but I've been forced to watch them, and the car chases at least are done with real cars. This was like watching just a video game cutscene to me. You can't play it, but you know, it looks exciting.
Sure. But they introduced something here that I thought was funny, because they emphasized that they found this gate 5 years ago. No one's been able to solve it, but they do this race every day at, you know, 2 p.m. the same time. But so he and H are like driving along, and they see Artemis for the first time, and they sort of like do like an extended take. They both look at her, and H goes, "Whoa, she's driving Canada's bike from Akira." And so they've been doing this every day for 5 years, but they're still taking time to like marvel that like someone is using a piece of pop culture or has like a Thundercats sticker on their windshield type of thing, as if it's not just a minor detail that no one could possibly be excited about in this world.
Right. There's characters from every conceivable bit of pop culture walking back and forth constantly. That's what you live in. That's your planet.
But it's sort of something that they do. It reminded me of how when we do Harry Potter movies, we would be like, okay, so Ron Weasley, his character has been established. He's grown up from day one with wizard parents. His wizards were brothers and sisters. They were surely changing his diaper via magic. And then he gets to Hogwarts and they're like, here's the spell where we're going to make a cake float. And he's like gawking at it with these wide eyes, like, oh, and like, Hermione, you know, they've been at school for 3 years and stuff like that was still happening. It's like, magic exists. You know, this is not something that should inspire. But then, you know, he's driving through this race, our hero, and he, you know, King Kong leaps out and he sort of does the Spielberg, like look up with wide eyes at this thing. And it's like, yeah. Every day for 5 years, this has happened to you. What are you excited about by this?
I guess that's why when you have a goldfish and he's swimming around in his bowl, he's just wide-eyed the whole time, like, water. This is amazing. Look at this. There's more water over here. Wow.
Yes. And it continues to happen, too, though. You know, the Chucky is like a surprise to everybody that comes. They continue this race. He's unable to win it, but it is packed with some fun 80s references, like the Farrelly Brothers movie, Something About Mary is very
classic
quickly referenced.
Classic 80s.
To base the character's haircut on. The movie was played even more fast with and loose with those than the book did, I felt. We had references to the classic 80s property, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, that was a pivotal moment. That was interesting, and it was hanging out in the middle of nowhere. It had no tether to anything, but
yes.
Big old It's a Wonderful Life reference.
Yes, and then we had King Kong in this race, mm-hmm. Which even if it was the Dino De Laurentiis one, that would have been from the 70s. We had people online seem to be convinced that the dinosaur that chases him is the dinosaur from Jurassic Park, which they never really remarked on, but
I think it makes movements like it in it where okay. Sort of, yeah, it does. It's that one.
Okay. But so that classic 80s Jurassic Park, we had other things too that are going to come. Some of the tunes and stuff were sort of out of place if you're taking it at its face value. But that was sort of something in this movie that wasn't really as drilled down, like that all these things were going to come from Halliday's obsessions with 80s pop culture. In the movie, it was much more that it was going to be based on his life, essentially.
Yeah. In the book, they make no bones about it. He was obsessed with 80s pop culture. And even in that, he made a couple of missteps as far as what his references were. He didn't keep it tightly reined within that world. But the movie is just all over the map. And I assume that was from the fact that they were doing licensing up until the moment the print was being, you know, the digital print was being rendered. They were probably still making deals with it. So they had to leave it wide open. Like, you know, It's a Wonderful Life was pulled out of public domain. Can we use a reference to that? I assume that they just had to widen the universe going, we will probably get 3% of these things licensed by the time we do this movie. So you're going to have to widen your references, Mr. Klein.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense. Because so what I thought was like, oh, maybe it would be cool to have these, you know, characters on screen and stuff. And people did seem to enjoy that. Like I found a quote that was like, so who here had a nerdgasm when the Stormtroopers, Power Rangers, and Halo Spartans were on screen at the same time?
That could be one of my least favorite sentences that has ever been uttered by any human being.
Marge Schott's Hitler had some good ideas, and then that one. But the way that those scenes were integrated, I think clearly was what you're talking about, because most of these scenes with these characters and stuff, which is what you're meant to take away as your big enjoyment of this thing, like were just like sort of wide group scenes, either characters running into battle or just like sort of walking through the club, where I guess people are going to enjoy pausing that when they get home and being like, oh, there's Blanca from Street Fighter doing nothing, like sort of talking to somebody. But I think that they did have that sort of aspect where they were going to need to plug these people in once they had got these things. So that's why he never interacts with any of these people. He never goes up to, you know, Mario, and it's like, hey, what's going on, Mario? Because that would be ridiculous. They're always just sort of hanging out somewhere else for you to spot.
Yeah, I wondered if they actually considered briefly doing a pop-up video style thing where they just label every character just so people can, you know, right. check. I'm sure they come in with a checklist and go, I better see so-and-so. And so, right. you know, just label them. Just put, this is who... He's in there. He's in there in 33 frames at right. 1 hour, 2 minutes, and 33 seconds. So right. yeah, well, we got him.
They sort of do that as the you know, with that, is that, that's Canada's bike from Akira. It's like, okay, that's terrific. Like, you can spot it from your DeLorean. But yeah, I think the other thing they did that was just because probably Steven Spielberg had the idea that was like, This is nonsense. This is a stupid way to frame a treasure hunt. Like, if you make it based on this guy's life, at least there's going to be some sort of emotional connection to it. So they do realize that they've got to go into Halliday's like museum, I guess, which he has preserved memories in sort of these museum set pieces. So our character goes there to look for advice, and they go through the some quizzes about the guy, like what his favorite things were, which is all, you know, Rush and all that sort of thing. But they revealed that his favorite restaurant was Chuck E. Cheese, which I thought was funny.
Once again, refer that back to your diagnoses of him as a character.
Yes,
I think that is evidence in your favor.
He's just sort of like staring at the rat as he's performing Happy Birthday, like just wide eyed. And but it would have provided some good challenges too. Like, you could have found the jade key by finding the most urine soaked ball in the ball pit, or you know, by who can cheat the easiest at ski ball by just dropping the balls into the 50-point ring.
I do wish they'd had a scene where he popped out of the balls, you know, that creepy dude. The little kid right there. Hey, did you know that I invented...
where are you going? Well, that comes up later. We've got a... That was a fun thing to sort of to realize the second viewing through. But so the way he gets the hint about how he's going to win this race is he goes and watches one of these museum set pieces, which is the office party, where he and his co-creator Og are sweeping up and discussing, you know, the future of the company and how things have changed from what they wanted it to be. And Halliday sort of just literally stares at the camera, stares at the people outside this thing, and is like, what if we went backwards? What if we put the pedal to the metal and went backwards? And the character who's stated that he has watched this scene 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And memorized it.
And keep in mind, watching the scene means, so he's in a virtual world, but he has to go to a museum.
Yes.
He has to talk to a curator. They walk yeah. down a hall. Then they look into a room that is sort of sealed off and provides like a, you know, a 360 view of this scene. But he has to go through all of this, and he's watched it 1,000 times. It's not something that you just have on your tape. Like, it's a Walkman that you can run back
right.
and play it. You have to go to a museum. So I mean, the museum is free. So maybe he makes a donation every time
yes,
he goes
exactly.
in. But still, 1,000 viewings of it.
He doesn't even have the ability to, like, when you listen to a podcast at 1.25 speed, if you're just trying to get the information out of it. He's like, rewind. Enhance type of thing. So the and, first 1,000 times.
Yeah. And keep in mind, this is an office argument, and it's a pretty bland one at that. There's nothing really, there's no fireworks in the actual scene that we're watching for the apparently 1,001st time. you know, you're not watching the Second Continental Congress here. There's not anything interesting yeah. happening. There's not, wow, that's George Washington. Wow, that's, no, that's two guys in a cafeteria. So
yeah. yeah, it's sort of setting the what's supposed to be a theme is that he's regretful of the way that he treated this partner. So there's maybe some hints of that were in this scene, but it doesn't really matter, because what you're looking for is when he looks you in the eye and says, go backwards. And it's like, wow, that really should have stood out at me the first time I saw this, because it's weird and unnatural.
Right.
So he does that. He goes through. He finds the key. Everyone else finds the key, like the main characters that were introduced to is H, Artemis, Dato, and Sho. At some point in time during this process, H utters a line that says that she had nearly soiled my haptics when they were doing the race. And it just seemed like, if you're having this issue, H, it's there's a simple solution to this, and that an issue would be several discrete openings in your haptics, because that would
yeah, come on. Would, well, I don't want to get into indelicate situations here, but you know, for H, are there different discrete? How? Anyway,
So they move on to the second challenge, which they're sort of trying to seek out. The clue was like a creator who hates his own creation, like, and there was something about taking a leap, something like that. So they go back to the museum, Artemis and our hero. And they're reviewing another one of these museum things, and it's about Halliday going on a date with someone who turned out to be Ogden Morrow's wife later, and she became his wife. But they went for a date, but he never could put the moves on her, and so that turned out to be his ultimate regret, that he never like tried to kiss somebody. So that's something that you imagine might be like a lifelong regret when you're in seventh grade and like haven't kissed somebody, but once you get older, you're like, well, all right. That there's a little more that you might be hoping what happens once you get past there. So that's not your only opportunity to do this, man.
Yeah, this is the lifelong regret of a guy who, what is it, he died in his early 70s, something like that?
Oh, maybe he was that old. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe 60s. I don't know. But we did leap over one little thing that struck me in the film itself that I never really thought of in the book was the portrayal of him as his alter ego, his Anorak?
Yes, his Anorak avatar.
Yeah, which is, I thought, really like sub-video game Gandalf. He kind of looked like he was maybe homeless or maybe between homes or something, like maybe living in his car. And I don't know whether that was a joke on him being like, I'm going to take Gandalf and make him, you know, socially awkward and weird, but he's not, it's not an, why would anyone do that? You know, you can do mm-hmm. anything, make him an inspiring, even better than Gandalf, the platinum or something, but no, yes. This is, makes Radagast the Brown look like a put together guy. Yes. And I just thought that was a strange choice. And he did not look good, like rendered. Yeah. It was creep. It was Uncanny Valley, but it was also somehow a little bit worse than what you find in a video game. Anyway, I just noted that. It's a strange, strange choice.
Yeah, it is a strange choice because a lot, you know, I think people were surprised sort of by how much of the movie ended up taking place in the virtual world. The actors are, I would say it was probably 25-75, you know, maybe 70-30, which I don't have a problem with because I found the main guy to be a big lump of a screen presence.
He is hard to look at. I mean, you know, he's just as God made him, but the choice to put him on screen in welding goggle glasses was just an odd choice.
Yeah, he does it. His trademark move was it's impossible to replicate in an audio medium, but he pulls off his VR mask and just sort of has this sort of dull cow expression on his face whenever he's alarmed by something, which happens several times throughout the movie. But it was what he really brought, as far as I was concerned, a look of lip pursed uncertainty and unawareness of what was going on.
Whereas his avatar brought, I thought, one of the strangest walks I've ever seen. Yes. This is also impossible to describe. His gait, as he sort of did a Sherman Helmsley from the Jeffersons kind of walk, but maybe more shuffling on the balls of his feet, and kind of there was a lot of extraneous motion in his walk. And
there was some shoulder movement, like where he's sort of trying to strut, and it wasn't really consistent through the whole thing. But in the very first scenes of the movie, it was very prominent, and I noticed it immediately. It kind of reminded me, this is an obscure thing, but it's something we fixated on. There's like a scene in Titanic where there's an obviously CGI character that sort of struts across the deck of the boat in a very awkward stance, and that was what I kept thinking of.
Yeah, that one was more that was like a Lego figurine being moved. But
I was, you know, as he's doing this walk, it's like, well, so you're imitating this on your treadmill in your trailer park hideout. It was puzzling.
Yeah, the bouncing up and down was unnecessary. Anyway, I think that was mainly to show like how far we've come with digital hair, maybe, because his hair was always bouncing around, which I found distracting. But
right, yeah, the something about Mary haircut was very, very buoyant. But so based on this clue, like Artemis gets a gets some ideas, which is surprising because they watch this scene of him having gone on this date, and Artemis had no idea that the villain Nolan Sorrento worked for Halliday in like a intern capacity. She had no idea that Halliday went out with Og's wife at all, which is something that, you know, these people who have been researching him and spending all this time for 5 years studying, she's terrible at gunting is the main takeaway there.
Yeah, she must have been going into the museum and just, you know, wandering into different sections or sitting outside in the by the water fountain and reading a book instead. She was not drilling down and watching scenes of him, you know, 1,000 times like our hero was.
Right. It was before they were common, like going to a museum was the only real place as a kid you'd ever encounter touch screens. So sometimes you'd just go up to the exhibits and just like touch those just to sort of interact with them without reading anything or taking them away what was on them. So maybe that's what her, she was up to in the museum. Maybe that was just me.
Yeah, yeah. And adults loved you when you were a kid.
But so she gets the idea of where they need to go. And the idea is to the dance planet, one of the centerpieces of the book, with the Groove Zone and the R2-D2 DJ, who sadly did not make an appearance. But they show up at this place dressed to the nines like Buckaroo Banzai. And they
his favorite movie.
which they go out of their way to say, like, he's trying on outfits for H. And he's like, Thriller and, you know, punk. And then he's like, he puts on Buckaroo Banzai. He's like, you're going to go as the character from your favorite movie?
That's so clunky.
So they show up here, and she's, you know, in this weird, you know, sort of, I guess it's supposed to be a sexy suit. Artemis had another very weird avatar too. She had, they ditched the Rubenesque look, very offensive, but they made her into a very just normal looking chick with very large eyes though, a very sort of, not really anime, but like alien anime maybe.
Yeah, I also found her disturbing to look at. Again, that when you're playing around in that uncanny valley, you're not going to hit it right, and I don't think they did. And they also, I guess this must be a nod or a reference to something, or to heighten the fact that they were avatars in a virtual reality. They had textured skin. Hard to describe the texture, sort of a lacing or an inlay to their skin that gave it a basket weave texture or something.
Yeah, it was sort of like a net.
Maybe this is referencing a video game. I don't know it. It was disturbing to me.
Right. Well, and there was no need for it. You were never going to mistake these characters for their real world counterparts. No.
Most people don't have eyes four times the size of actual humans.
But yeah, so they start dancing, and then he throws on another classic 80s reference, which is he starts playing the Bee Gees' "Staying Alive" on the dance floor. And so she remarks, whoa, old school. And so I noted, I wrote it down and looked it up afterwards. She had interrupted the song Blue Monday by New Order, which came out in 1983, to play Staying Alive, which came out in 1977. So it really is old school if you're going back 6 years in order to a blast from the past there.
Right. And then so this is a zero gravity dance floor, which seems to be, it seems like zero gravity could exist anywhere at any time, any place, right. Like, but everyone's really excited to go on the zero gravity dance floor, which they do. And then we discover that he can react to her touch through his microfiber crotch inlay. She yes. sort of snakes her way through his crotch, and then we see like a little sort of digital feedback, and then cut to him in his little trailer in real life, sort of going, whoa.
Yeah, exactly.
My microfiber crotch inlay is doing some business down there, which comes up later. But
yeah, somehow there is an actual payoff to that, and it's even stupider than you might have suspected.
Right.
But this the guys break in, they shoot everything up, and they he's able to reverse time using his Zemeckis cube, which he went when he got his first payday. He went and bought all these sort of virtual artifacts that you can use to control time and weapons and all that sort of stuff. But as they've stopped time, she sort of has a moment to talk to him about, because he's telling her he loves her, because they've met twice. And she's like, this isn't a game, man. Like, and she reveals her backstory, which is that her dad was taken by the IOI loyalty centers, which play a bigger role in the book than they did in the movie. These are the debtor prisons. Her dad went to one. He thought he was going to get out, But then IOI, in the supreme act of evilness, they've raised his living expenses. And he went bankrupt.
Right. Which all the great villains do. I know that Macbeth, when he realized that Banquo was set against him, he subtly raised his living expenses, and that's when his ghost appeared to haunt him. So
Banquo's looking at the paper. He's like, the price of Burnham Wood is just shot through the roof. Like, oh, my God. Like, I'm going to have to cut back on – oh, and he killed himself. But, yeah, so that's – they sort of set that story up because she's going to end up going to this prison. But this is a major – not it's a major thing in this, in the movie, because that's sort of a point at the end that they shut these prisons down. But it's not that big of a deal because no one really cares, because it's not an opportunity for Street Fighter II characters to appear on the screen.
Yeah, and it comes up – well, we'll get to it at the end. But the cops show up and everything, and those things never – so are these centers are fully endorsed by whatever obviously very strict and well-run government is, you know, there's a legislation signed off on these and giving right. them power. That is all sort of glossed over. Like, yeah, they have the power to just imprison, you know, it's a, you know, personal police force that exists yes. somewhere right. within the actual police force. Don't ask any questions.
Yes, exactly. But the police force does play another role later in the story. So it is still up and running. It just is a... you know, you could make yourself go crazy trying to pick apart how this would actually work in a real setting. So the guy didn't care, and I don't think we should either.
No, right.
But yeah, so he goes up and he ends up talking to Sorrento, who's in this movie is sort of a he's sort of a inept, and they sort of try to play that for laughs. He sort of is a weak, I guess, kind of guy, but he also is in charge of these. You know, he's still in charge of these debtor prisons and stuff. So he is 100% evil. But he goes and has the discussion with him, the one in the book where he appears as in a chat link. He's a hologram in the thing. And it has a part in the movie where it cuts to Sorrento's trying to impress him, make sure that he knows that they're not so different, you and I. And it cuts to the guys who work for him feeding him like lines to say to Wade into his earpiece where he's like – telling him that, you know, hey, I want to rename every school to be like the ones in Fast Times at Ridgemont High or the Breakfast Club, which was a creative scene to give him that.
They're also
credit.
Yeah, he's quickly telling him, explaining that he's just like him by I drink Tab. I play Robotron to relax.
I listen to Duran Duran.
But that is sniffed out by Wade. He senses that he's not an authentic Gunter. He knows. I mean, part of the clue may be that he runs a multi-trillion-dollar company.
Yes.
And benefits greatly from finding this Easter egg, and that he gets to then own everything in the world. So
yes.
That's a
it's
good
the
clue.
It's the classic politician you'd want to have a beer with type of thing, where, you know, these, you know, that's how voters make their decision, being like, this guy seems like me. And it's like, this guy wakes up every day at 4 a.m. to like manage his billions. Like, what on earth are you talking about? This guy's never done anything that you've ever done since he was like a teenager.
Right. I think actually Mr. Burns could have done a better job of convincing someone that he's. Yes. I wheel a steel hoop down the street just like anybody else.
But during this scene, Wade is sort of taking it all in his photographic memory. And one of the key mistakes that Sorrento made was leaving his password written on a Post-it note on the side of his rig.
Yep, and his half a Post-it note, which when I write mine and stick them, you know, on the wall behind my laptop, I usually put the whole Post-it note. But he had half, to be a little more discreet about it.
Right. And so, you know, I don't know about you, but even these days when I register for like the gym, if I'm like putting them on my online account for that so that I can pay my bill, even that is like, yeah, you need to make a password that has like three special characters, a capital letter, an emoticon in it. Like, but and it won't let you register it otherwise. But Sorrento's password to log into his entire IOI rig controlling his trillion-dollar company is Bossman69.
Right.
Which he needed help remembering, so he wrote it down on a piece of paper.
He did use fives for the S's. That's impenetrable. You know, that the password thing is so frustrating when you're doing something like, you know, I have to send a gift basket to my friend who just his niece is having. And I was like, all right, well, there's a gift basket place in his town. I'll send him this. And then I have a password bank, you know, so it generates. Yeah. it generates a high level password automatically, right. But it gets rejected by this little podunk. It's like, look, damn it, just take this one. I have to now add care. I have to read the four paragraphs of how my password is supposed to go. I can't just plug it in.
And then you like look at the characters aloud and it's like, oh, is that a semicolon that I'm not supposed to put in there? Like, you know, all the stuff on the, you know, shift, all the numbers is okay, but what's
just let
we
me
live in it. A hellscape.
Yes.
I don't know a single one of my passwords, but then, so they realize that what they've got to do is they've got to go into the place, the movie that, Halliday took Ogden Morrow's wife, to go to, which it turns out, you know, they justify it saying the creator who hates his own creation, is Stephen King because he didn't like the movie The Shining. And so that's a loose interpretation of that because Stephen King's fine with his creation. He likes The Shining. He evidently likes the direct-to-TV adaptation of The Shining, but he had nothing to do with the book, with the Stanley Kubrick movie. So it's a it's clever, but it's not entirely accurate.
It's also that's a strange thing to pick out of that. There's many, many things you could have gotten out of that. I mean, that just it's not the thing you automatically go to and they all are 100% sure. We've got it.
Right.
You know, that's what happens with all the clues, which I think are pretty ambiguous and sometimes ambivalent, where you just go, I guess that could be it, but you could be sure. Going down a complete rabbit hole. But no, they always run off with 100% confidence.
That was sort of the bone we had to pick with the book, too. It's like there wasn't any aspect of fun to solving these things. It was something that only these characters in the book could really interpret and then with exact certainty fly to that planet and discover the Captain Crunch whistle or something. So they go to The Shining, and this is another thing, like the Halliday performance that was praised by a lot of people as a great set piece in this movie. And I thought it was pretty stupid. I like The Shining. I like all the weird theories around The Shining. I find those are a lot of fun. And this sort of just shows up and takes the greatest hits from it and sort of turns it into one of those rides at Disneyland where you sit and the theater sort of moves around with you. Star Tours or Body Wars. I don't know if that still exists, but my dad threw up on it after we went there.
Yeah, and as with all of these things we've said many times, this is now you're in a lot of times you're in a video game that you can't play. Now you're on a theme park ride that you're not actually on. So,
right.
And you're watching, I find, an annoying character going through annoying and slightly problematic character, I would also say.
Yes. Yeah. So they established that this is a scary movie. And they say that H is evidently very afraid of scary movies. Sho had to watch it through his fingers, he said, but doesn't like him. In the beginning of the movie, it showed H on planet Doom, blasting guys with a gigantic gun with one hand as she's leaping and throwing a grenade with another hand through this, war-torn planet. So that's something that she does every day. But scary movies, or at least going into a simulation of a scary movie, is going to be different than that somehow.
You made several problematic statements there. She, did you say?
Well, H is a she.
Well,
the character in the book opts not to refer to her as that because it doesn't matter to him, or something along those lines.
Oh, yeah. Do they say? I never noticed that. In this movie, is it she all the way through?
No, I think it was a surprise when she shows up as the, in the movie. I think she says a flat, fat black chick. I mean, in the book, she says that. I think that's still a surprise.
Oh, I thought maybe it could still just be a surprise about that she was a black chick, as she says. Yeah. I didn't know how much of the, but doesn't matter either way. Yeah, it's weird to watch this character whose voice is just pitched down a little bit, I guess, to do the disguise, which does not work. And it sounds very odd to me.
Yes.
I never was comfortable with that voice. It was not pleasant to listen to. And it didn't sound like, I want this person to always be a sidekick with him. I was like, ugh, this
exactly.
is exactly. This is
it
annoying.
Was like, when we decided to make the disembodied voice, I think, Rick, the sound guy, was just like, I don't know, pitch shift this down in this effect. How does it sound? We're like, I guess that's okay. But it was his first choice of let's just disguise this sort of vaguely. And I think that's pretty much what they did with H's voice. It's like, I don't know, this effect seems to work.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so H is sort of scared of this. So it's it just reminded me of Mr. T and the A-Team, this vaguely sort of stereotype of black people don't like horror movies, and so it's like, hey, I ain't getting on that plane, fool. type of thing, because it's like, you know, I ain't going in there.
Yeah, and I would even say out of context, The Shining, because H was not familiar with The Shining as part of it, right?
Right, yes, he had never seen it.
So out of context, these things are not in the least bit scary. Right. I mean, on its face, there's two little girls. I guess there's something mildly, I don't know, I wouldn't be unsettled if I just saw two girls. I guess they speak in kind of a monotone, but I go, hey, what's with you two cuties? What's going on? You know?
Right.
My immediate thing would not be to scream and run.
Right. The only reason that's funny is if you're familiar with that cliche.
Right. And even the blood coming out of the elevators, well, I mean, I don't know. It could be the Kool-Aid man doing it. Yeah. I don't know.
And it's not blood. You're well aware that you're in a virtual world because you spend 20 hours a day in a virtual world. But then, yeah, you know, the naked zombie chick comes, and that's, you know, probably a little disturbing, but
she's quite used to this, as you said, used to this.
They didn't make any excuses for why she couldn't have her gigantic guns or whatever in this environment either. So, yeah, it was dumb, and it didn't really have a payoff, because at the end, they just sort of go into the ballroom, and they realize that the woman that he didn't kiss is sort of in the middle of this haunted mansion, ghost ballroom kind of scene with all these zombies. Someone says, zombies weren't in The Shining. And someone says, oh, well, The Shining stuff was just a diversion.
Well, then why did you bring us in? Why did he set up a whole Shining house? Damn you, Shining house.
So they go through. They just have to, like, jump across the zombies to get to this girl and ask her to dance. And that was the whole thing. He didn't have the balls to do that. He needed to take the leap. And going through this this sort of flick sync was just a means to asking her to have this dance.
Yep, that's what kind of a weird guy this Halliday is. And that's whoever can do that kind of stuff for some reason is a moral hero, which we'll get into that a little bit later, too. But
yeah, they sort of they've been intercutting through to the villains this whole time. They have the T.J. Miller character, who is Irock, who is briefly in the book, and so this is not the same character. He's a big skull guy who's clearly evil, and he sort of, they let him come in and probably vamp around on the microphone and put those in the movie, and, you know, whatever. It was.
Timing wise, couldn't be better. TJ Miller's doing great.
It really was. There was a line about where you were like, yeah, he was glancing out of the corner of his eye to see if they're ever going to stop recording him, because he was like, yeah, to me, that's like a Tootsie Pop. You remember that commercial with the owl? Yeah. The villain's like, keep it going. It's great time to kill. Comic relief.
His major character trait is that he has a stiff neck. Isn't that it? Or
he's hurt his neck somehow in his rig.
Yeah, he keeps going back to that. You know, but I'll be okay. Just kind of stuttering. I mean, it is not something to be proud of.
No, it was a hey, hey, I'm Krusty the Clown. Here's Sideshow Mel performance. yes. If he was in the studio for more than half an hour, I would be stunned.
Future generations who watch this. Wait, what am I saying? No future generations will watch this. But if they do, they will be puzzled by TJ Miller's performance.
This was something that I marked this. I said it out loud to you in the theater. I planned to say it. And then in the live show, it got I think a person coughed when I made this comparison, but T.J. Miller is presenting him with a orb of Ossivox, which he is going to, like, shield the entire planet. And he holds it up, and inside, I noted there was a dodecahedron type of thing, a 20-sided object. And I was like, that looks just like the emissary from Armada. And I made that point to a packed house at Sisyphus Brewery. That was my imitation of their reaction just there. That
no,
seconds of silence.
I swear, I heard a distant dog barking and a screen door slamming. Yes. Somehow, a tumbleweed actually rolled through Sisyphus Brewing.
Why are you here if you haven't listened to this podcast?
That was a stunning a number of people who hadn't, who seemed to enjoy it, but the deep dives were a dangerous place to go.
There was one cow shirt in the audience.
There was
one hell of a red cow shirt, and it was on a Tom Servo robot, which was nice for me because I didn't have to buy a robot a beer. But I was very nice to see that it was a children's size. I was glad that the person who bought the children's size was not buying it for an actual child. So that was a relief, but that was a fun sight. So this is when they decide to take our hero out. They plant the bomb in his stacks. They blow it up. Gigantic explosion. He's running to it to sort of warn his aunt and her boyfriend, but it collapses. And so, as we discussed in the podcast, this has killed hundreds of people. And they sort of again don't really focus on the human lives lost. They sort of show the character walking towards the camera, like his face is darkened in soot, and it just reminded me of like Daffy Duck once he's been blown up, and he's sort of walking to the camera, being like, "This means war."
Yes, they blew up my stacks. Yeah, that is a strange moment. He makes zero effort to see if anyone that he loves is alive in this burning, right, twisted wreckage. Zero effort. And then just sort of dusts his hands off and goes, "Boy, that was mean, That wasn't very nice."
Right. But so then he gets sort of abducted by Artemis's henchmen, because Artemis has a whole crew working for her, even though she doesn't clan up. That's something that people say a lot during this. That and a running joke of our character left hanging for a high five was also just a delightful thing that I was amused by every time it happened. But they develop a plan, since our hero does have a photographic memory, which maybe is something from the book that they were carrying over. But they ask him how much he remembered about Sorrento's office, and he says pretty much everything. So they hack Sorrento's rig. How did they do this? Doesn't matter, Mike. They say we hacked his rig multiple times, and that's all we need to know.
They do it within minutes. I mean, because they get him, because he's online, and then they make him think that he takes off his own VR goggles and is IRL in real life at that point, which, I mean, that already strains credulity, but I guess he does have a hell of a rig. So the rig is making his own hands feel like they're moving up to his own face and pulling off his own VR rig. Is that what we're led to believe?
It sort of gets inception-y at this point in time where, it's a rig within a rig. But they recreated it so meticulously, like down to the details that are unfortunate, because he includes in this a detail that gives him away. Where Sorrento sort of glances at the armrest of his rig and sees a reflection of them like hanging out in the background, like in their avatars. So we know that it is not real.
Why did you build your avatars behind the shiny thing that you built on his chair? Why did you do that? We could have been in a completely different room. Why did we leave the door open? It's all very strange, but he sees it, realizes he's been inceptioned, and then they're discovered.
Right. And so this is sort of how they then they move into the final act, which is they broadcast his conversation with him, and they tell everybody that he's evil and he blew up his your favorite line of this, I think, was when he confronts him about killing his aunt.
Yes. "You killed my mom's sister," he says with passion.
That classic way to refer to your aunt.
Your aunt.
But yeah, so they've got this evidence. They know that everyone's a bad guy, and they go into the world, and they say, like, they introduce the concept of the high five for the first time. He's like, "I come in the name of Dato and Sho." And I just imagined like most of the people being like, "What are you? Oh, are the guys at the top of this, who are they teamed up? Like, why are they even hanging out together? Like, aren't they in competition against you? I don't really understand what's going on here."
Yeah, we know nothing about them, really. We just know when we go and play a game that their scores are higher than us. Otherwise, we don't really have any emotional attachment to them.
But he sort of, I think this is the first time he introduces the concept of the high five, which is a really, really thin concept in this one. But they do have those people, and I guess that was probably the high five joke he was left hanging for a couple times. Anyway, H is driving around her postal service van, and she picks up our hero, and he gets to meet these guys for the first time, which introduces another hilarious running joke that Sho, who is a yellow yellow suited Kill Bill style ninja in this movie, is not what you would expect, which is a adult yellow suited ninja, but a 11-year-old or 12-year-old.
Yep, shocking, isn't it?
The notorious group of guys who don't like to play video games, 12-year-olds.
Right. Well, this is such, as we talked about in the book, such a strange thing to focus on. when you are in a world filled with avatars, you would never, ever have an expectation of anyone being similar to his or her avatar. You wouldn't, yes. It wouldn't even cross your mind. I mean, most of the avatars you see are, you know, skulls or dogs or like, yeah. I was surprised to learn it was not a dog. Like, what are you saying? I mean, right. It's so
Hello
bizarre.
Kitty walks by and yeah, so it is a strange blind spot, and one that would have been easily, if it was, you know, if it was a 80-year-old woman, it would have been like, yeah, I'm an 80-year-old woman. I play video games. I'd like to be a ninja. So what? But it's like, okay, yeah, like every 12-year-old loves ninjas. It's
and I also like rapping. Boom.
Yes. Granny, please. People have died. But yeah, so they're entering this final place where they're all going to storm the castle. And this is where we get the – everyone's rushing into this battle. And that's where you really get to – if you love like 0.25 seconds pans across characters that you may or may not recognize, this is really the sweet spot of the movie.
Oh, you are in heaven at this scene. And I'm sure there are theaters – where even now, where you could probably get the projectionist to stop the film and you all just sit there and yell out the characters. Yes. I'm sure that'll be like the version of a sing-along, right? Or a Rocky Horror Picture Show where you just get to, just with glee, recognize things that are on screen.
Yes. So we watched it a second time. So the first time I sort of took it all in and was like, wow, this is how it's going to be. Second time I was like, just keeping more of an eye out for things. And it was still... you know, I thought it was a tricky thing to sort of take all these things in because they all, you know, the battle scenes are chaotic and they have 100 characters on screen. But I was like, okay, yeah, there's a Street Fighter 2. Okay. Moving along. I think that's what that is. But I you know, that guy who had the nerdgasm, I noticed the Halo guys. I didn't see the Power Rangers or the whatever the hell else he was talking about. So, you know, I know what a Power Ranger looks like. I just didn't really I was looking for him. Didn't see him.
This would have been a time, in fact, for, you know, going back to that, what is it, Kaneda's bike or whatever?
Yeah.
From Akira. This would have been a time to just stop again and just for him to recognize all the characters. Whoa, that's so-and-so from, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Just stop at this pivotal moment and go, guys, just hang on. I know we're tactically, this is a terrible thing to do, but I need to identify each one of you as you run past.
Well, you're joking about that, but they do that. Someone tosses Chucky from Child's Play into the thing, and the villain goes, "Is that Chucky?" It's like, yeah. Well, I mean, he's attacking a Battletoad. What are you? Why is it surprising to you?
Who's? Why is he getting the shout out here?
Yeah. So they do like all the characters mobilize. H has been constructing a life-size replica of. Notorious warmonger, the Iron Giant, in her garage.
Right.
And so she activates that for the first time, which was one of my favorite moments because very briefly they cut back to the van where it shows them in the virtual world doing stuff. And you get a sense of how stupid this would look if they just showed them all there punching and kicking in virtual with their helmets on. But it does show her sort of like going like and moving her arm to like free the Iron Giant from his things. And it was just a little taste of how dumb this really is.
Yeah. You have to generate the grrs and everything yourself. You can, those are not, can we just build those in? Let's just assume he's going to growl and be menacing. I feel kind of dumb doing it myself.
Right. And so that's a good other thing to talk about is that like, so that's the Iron Giant. It comes up and they sort of, you know, as it is in the real movie, it's a sympathetic character. But they try to make that in this case, even though H is, you know, in the van with them, there's no negative consequences to the Iron Giant dying or anything, but they have it sort of like wincing as it's, you know, sort of giving its life to help these people cross the bridge. It when it dies, it falls into the lava. And I guess H is in the van sitting there next to all these people, but also making it do the Terminator 2 thumbs up, as its dying gesture. So we're,
also, does her rig, does it generate that kind of heat, lava heat? I mean, if
right,
you're,
yeah,
you know, the crotch is able to do, yeah, you know, I don't know.
That would be, I mean, I think it said they can, like, it can detect, like, you know, they have the stink towers. They've probably got the heat vision on something or other, even though that would only be used to, you know, for negative things.
Inflict agony on your own body.
In the meantime, all these IOI guys are trying out various Atari games. And they sort of get the drop on these guys. They've discovered that adventure is probably the way to go. They have this whole team of idiots arguing with each other in the background, and they finally land on adventure because I guess it has the Easter egg in it. Maybe they don't know that. Anyway.
First Easter egg. And the idiots arguing in the background. Great costuming choice for them. Was it like baby blue sweaters? Or I recall sort of a pale, lame. Like they should have just worn, you know, full out nerd outfit. Like these bland idiots, you know. It was just an odd, like, are you really required to go to work at this tech company all dressed in blue sweater vests with shirts, collared shirts underneath them? And
it would be the sort of thing that, like, if there was a Mountain Dew commercial that was making fun of this and they were like, we went to our duologist to find out how to kick up the flavor, and then it cut to a very shitty nerd stereotype, it would be like, okay, yep, that's the that's what they put in this thing. They're taking out the guys to get to this thing. Our hero pulls out the holy hand grenade in the middle of this battle, which is, you know, it has nothing to do with Monty Python other than just getting that name drop in. In the middle of this fight, as he's about to throw it, Sho goes, well, you have a holy hand grenade. How much did that cost? Which, you know, sure, I guess he's 12, but like, he's got to focus. This is a battle show. This is wildly irrelevant at this point in time.
Yeah, that's one of the second only character trait of Sho. He's young and he's very obsessed with the costs of things. I guess that's the only thing we know.
But they go in and there's the console in this sort of like ice cavern where people are playing an Atari 2600. And as our hero is about to like take control, IROC and the Sorrentos show up and they settle this fight for the future of mankind by punching and kicking each other. But the Chekhov's microfiber crotch inlays pay off in a big way because the evil guy is wearing them. And our hero kicks him square in the nuts. And so you get a great scene of him doing the sort of like stumble out with his hand over his crotch, almost cross-eyed and falling to his knees. And he just has to be wondering to himself, like, why did I put this on?
Yeah, he's being helped out by two assistants. And I wish one of them would go, when you were strapping into the suit, I said, let's just leave the crotch kick component off of it. Sir, you're the head of a multi-trillion dollar company.
Yeah. No, also put in the thing that will like jab me in the ass. Put in the thing that makes a really loud noise in my ear.
You bought those off the dark web. Why? They're not even part of their add-ons.
Yeah. Put a viper on my lap. I want to be bitten by an actual snake during this proceeding. But yeah, so that was fun. I mean, we enjoyed that as we were watching. And I guess that's sort of a Spielbergian comeuppance to an adult authority figure.
I guess. I mean, I don't know. It would seem more likely that he would have transferred that to an actual rival rather than just some guy who owns a company. It's always weird when a full-grown adult who should be competent in every way is doing... I mean, it's like Karate Kid 3 or something, you know, where a guy abandons his pursuit of, and all of his shareholders to go pick on a little kid for a while. It doesn't make it dramatically very satisfying. It should have been someone his own age who somehow had different, you know, had an evil goal or whatever. But so those moments are always odd, yeah.
As they move on, he solves the adventure thing. He realizes that it wasn't beating the game you needed to do. You needed to discover the Easter egg, which is the creator's name, which, adventure is possibly the least cinematic game of all time. It's a square moving around it's like a TI-82 calculator game. But he finds that everyone's watching him do this, like the entire Oasis, including the nerds in the IOI control room, who they burst out cheering when he solves it. I guess they're pleased that they're going to be unemployed.
their turnaround is completely unmotivated and very strange. It's just we all just recognize this is what happens in movies.
Exactly. If you're in a control room, you got to cheer.
Yeah, I think the in Wizard of Oz, the witch's henchman when she dies is a yes. more clear turnaround. They're suddenly like, oh, thank you for killing her. Wait, you were just trying to murder me seconds ago. What's going on?
Yeah, well, you know, she just sort of, she had some dirt on me. I'm not going to lie. She, which took some pictures. I OEO'd when I shouldn't have.
Right. So they all turn on him. They want the same thing he does for unknown reasons.
And then he wins and he's taken to the throne room of Anorak the Almighty. And he offers him up the contract to sign, and he sort of delays around this. They're still driving around with other bad guys chasing them, and he's hemming and hawing though. And there's something that didn't really, I don't think, came across. He decides he's not going to sign the contract to take control of the Oasis because Halliday forced out his partner, Og. Our hero does not want to sign a contract assuming control of the Oasis.
Yes, which is then greeted with, that's what I just needed to see.
I needed to be sure, yeah.
Yeah, and that was very unclear for me. Having watched the whole film and read the book, I did not understand that.
Yeah, I think that's a Willy Wonka quote. I haven't looked it up, but I think Gene Wilder says that when Charlie returns the gobstopper to him, and he's like, "I had to be sure." Type of, so, but I don't know what he has to be sure about, because he's not screwing anyone over. He's not writing anyone out of the thing. He's not forcing anyone out. He's taking the thing that he was competing to win.
Yeah, no, I think it's just a reference. Yeah, a pure reference. It becomes the pivotal moment, which also, yeah. I should point out, just backing up slightly, it did make me laugh in the theater. We're deep in the third act, and he says out loud that the game Adventure, you're not even supposed to win it. You're supposed to go and find the Easter egg in an invisible room. And it just made me laugh. You know, when you state clearly what the pivotal moment is, and the pivotal moment is you're not supposed to win invisible room, I am just riveted to the screen. I can't wait to see. Yes. Why am I even watching this movie? I'll just go look at an invisible room. And
the MacGuffin is an invisible dot. That's how low we've sunk.
Yeah, so those moments and this moment, just again, they unspool just in a way that makes you go, I've recognized this from other things, and so I'm just going to accept without you having done the work that this is the moment I'm supposed to be cheering for. And that happens constantly throughout this movie, but especially in the third act.
Yeah, the one final test is probably a TV trope page. But so once he is overcome that final test, he is then again transported to a version of Halliday's childhood bedroom, which is, you know, your classic wood paneled, Rush postered 80s childhood bedroom. And he sees that Halliday is there in his he sort of looks like Fred Armisen in a fright wig and mom jeans. And then
he's very low energy, to quote the President of the United States. He does not seem like the exciting character. I mean, this is, as we fade into a coda to the third act, this is not the elves going off to across the sea or something. This is just an ugly bedroom with a weird dude in it wandering around.
Very weird, because he's keeping a 10-year-old version of himself in the room. There's a 10-year-old boy playing video games.
Mm-hmm.
And so Halliday is like, you know, well, here's the button to do this, to shut it all down if you want to, like, don't hit it. And our hero's like, what's going on here? And the guy in sort of his weird, not full version, but he's like, oh, I like to keep him around.
Do you now?
You keep a little boy version of yourself around who doesn't appear to be able to or allowed to talk. It doesn't really put, you know,
he's sort
you
of
never kissed
dead,
a girl. Like,
yeah, a dead eyed. The kid is not, you know, he doesn't give a smile. And like, this is not the Timmy of a movie, you know, like, hey, little fella, how you doing? This is like a weird, sad little kid sitting in front of and he's like dead eyed, like playing. I like to keep him around.
And it ends with them just like they're leaving. And Wade is like, wait a second. Are you really dead? Is this really an avatar? Which are, you know, not questions I had. I mean, I was like, oh, it's his avatar. But then to answer that, Halliday just goes, goodbye, Wade. And he takes the boy's hand and leads him out the door and closes it.
I think that answers your question.
No, it doesn't. Should I alert somebody? Is the boy dead? Like,
yeah. Which of you is real? Are you both real? If so, there are crimes being committed right at this moment.
So, you know, that's our hero. That's the grand vision. That's how that ends. And that was something that didn't really stick out to me the first time I watched it. That was something that was more of the second viewing, being like, wait a damn second.
Yeah. Why? I mean, the questions go on and on, but just on a very basic level, why that age? Why do you like to keep him around? It would have been less creepy if he'd had someone at every year of his life. I don't know.
Sure.
Just like hanging out with guys. But no, just at that age with the creepy silent kid. Anyway, enough said about that.
But yeah, so he signs the contract, and they the van drives to the stacks where a crowd sort of materializes, but Sorrento's right behind him, and he like gets out of the car, and he's, you know, people are like, oh, it's that bad guy, we all hate that guy. But then he pulls out a gun, and the hundreds of stacks survive, like guys who live there, the hardened masses, the people who, where when the thing exploded, people said, oh, it was probably just another meth lab explosion, and everyone accepted that because these people are so gritty and, like, you know, have nothing to lose. There's hundreds of them surrounding this guy. This guy pulls a gun, and they're like, whoa, back off.
Yep.
Not like,
not like immediately pulling out a flick knife and just stabbing him in the eye, which probably occurs thousands of times a day at the stacks.
Yeah. And they've just seen him admit that he, you know, planted a bomb and killed hundreds of their residents. It's like, you know, if one of the four Rodney King cops had showed up in Compton and they were like, you know, well, we got to back off. He's got a gun. Yes. As opposed to just a cinder block flying from nowhere and then, you know, stop. He's already dead.
Right.
But so he sort of, you know, he has a gun, but he's clearly not menacing at this point in time. And he opens the gate where, like, I forget what happened. I guess they arrest him. But the cops show up, the fully employed and funded cops show up and take him away.
Yeah. And this ends the movie. Is it's sort of a sitcom ending where our hero Wade and Artemis are kind of trying to kiss or have their moment, mm-hmm. whatever. And the doors to their van keep opening.
Yes.
And it's supposed to be comical every time. And it's like, wait, it's you? You know, it's like, I expected it to open. Like, the circus I used to work at? Is that,
yeah, exactly.
Is that Bingo the Clown? It is me. It's like these characters, you have no expectation of who's opening the van, but it is truly, you know, it's like a moment where the wacky neighbor just keeps barging in while you're trying. Would you please give us a moment's peace?
But, that creepy guy with the world's longest fingernails from the Guinness Book of World Records.
It's me.
they eventually, you know, do walk outside where they have another sitcom moment where they make a very broad lawyer joke, which was funny. But the one thing that as they sort of end this scene, we focused on was that there's people all throughout the background, all these extras who have headed out here with very hastily made signs. Yes. And they've sort of grabbed whatever was available and just started scrawling stuff on these signs. And they're the worst signs that I've ever seen. Like, I feel like, you know, we've recently discovered the value of funny signs at protests, because you can, you know, really quickly go viral if you have something that's like, you know, I guess I do this every week now, or like something like that. But these people, my top three signs in reverse order that people wrote were, yes, go show Artemis.
Exclamation point after. Yeah,
yes. Twice written. And then one that my favorite just says Dato.
No exclamation point.
like they took in Dato. Like, that was the least interesting member of this whole cabal. And they were like, I'm going to write his name on a sign.
And again, these are people at the stacks. These hardened people who've just suffered a horrible, horrible tragedy. I mean, this is very recent. The other thing I noted, the second viewing of it, because the signs intrigued me so much, I focused my eyes in the background rather than the foreground. And, the cops show up, and then the cops switch into, they call backup and they do crowd control because the people in the sign with the signs are going crazy and ecstatic over what they've seen here for some reason. Yeah. And there's just a guy, you can see these extras, one guy playing the cop extra is holding his arms, you know, sort of vaguely off to the sides as though to bar people from coming past him. And there's one guy who keeps sort of rocking back and forth just to add background motion. And the two of them are clearly just like, so what do you do for a living? You know, how'd you get the day off? And they're pretty prominent, like right over the shoulder of the action. And they're there for the whole time this scene goes on. It made me laugh so hard. Like, there's clearly not trying to get past the guy who's clearly not trying to
right,
stop him.
Yes. I like that we spent, you know, multiple minutes criticizing the movie for being just like, you know, here's a, you know, character from Contra in the background. Here's Hello Kitty walking by. It's impossible to notice for a quarter of a frame. And yet we've gone been like, oh, there's a sign back there, sort of in the top right corner. That
right.
But they were funny. It was very stupid.
It's just something that you are supposed to accept as that these people would go out. But that's the funny thing about it. Who went to the store? Did you buy poster board? Some of them were cardboard boxes. I thought that was fair enough. That's
probably easily available in the stacks because of all the goods and services.
Yeah, so right. Yeah, the drone Pizza Hut box probably got turned into a sign. But yeah, they've also got High Five merchandise printed. I think the first time that was mentioned was as he was starting this battle. So that was a pretty quick job. That's like the guys who print up bootleg, you know, Super Bowl champion shirts that are available in the parking lot afterwards type of thing. So kudos right. to that guy.
Right.
And then they move on and they sort of wrap it up pretty quickly. It cuts to they sign some contract. He decides he's going to share it with his friends. So I guess lesson learned or whatever. And then they cut to his, sort of loft. It looks sort of like the friend's apartment where he's got a pinball machine and he's smooching Artemis on the couch. And he's like, yeah, so we did that and we closed down all the loyalty centers. And, we realize that reality is real. So we're going to shut down the Oasis on Tuesday and Thursday. See ya.
Yeah. That's not even a half measure. That is, a 2/7 measure there.
But yeah, it was a funny thing though, too, because they were like, all right, we're going to shut down for 2 days out of the week. Are there any logical days that we should pick here? Any days when people are typically, maybe not working or wouldn't need to access these schools that we're providing in this system. Tuesday and Thursday seem like the ones for me. That's the really break people's week up into three unmanageable chunks there.
Right. So, yeah, that I don't know that we mentioned that, but all the schools and everything exist within that world.
Uh-huh.
So you're shutting down all commerce and all public and private and parochial, and also was the Tuesday and Thursday, was it a sort of a subtle slam that they didn't want anybody going to church on Sunday or,
There was probably Mrs. G was going to church on Sunday in her virtual world.
Right.
Wow. We had a pretty good deep dive into his world of faith in the live podcast, but I guess that was that will be lost for time.
Yeah, well, over on my other podcast, like Trees Walking, we're going to revisit that. We're going to also do this exercise. So,
all right. Well, yeah. So check that out. That was a fun and intriguing aspect of the live show that you won't want to miss if you've made it this far.
That's right.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the movie. They didn't even really do anything fun with the credits, which I was surprised by. You would have thought there could have been like fake bloopers or something with all the characters or something like that. Or
I thought, freeze frame on background characters and then have wacky, the guy from Halo went on to,
right.
He was killed in Vietnam. I don't know.
But no, they sort of just, they like cue Hall & Oates and get out of here, folks. We'll see you for the Armada treatment directed by, the guy who did Jurassic World in 3 years.
That is a dead certainty that we will be back doing that, isn't it?
Oh.
I mean, Armada is 100% greenlit.
They've said that there's a guy writing it who's written some movie we didn't see and would never see. But, that's something that you announce during this type of thing. And I think the bloom is going to come off this rose, I think, very quickly. So
I heard Werner Herzog is in talks to make Armada. I'd go see that.
So part of the reason that this was so successful is, one, they all the marketing focused on Steven Spielberg, I think, or at least the majority of it. So I think that was the faith they had in the cast and the Klein in order to sell this thing. I think they really relied on the most beloved director of all time, which is a good safe bet.
Yeah, that's the way I go too. And judging from the people in our room when we did this podcast, keep in mind this podcast is nothing but talking about the works of Ernest Klein. We announced for weeks that we would be seeing the movie and dissecting it as we just have, very, very minutely and scene by scene. And I'd say maybe a third of the people in that room had seen the movie.
So. Curious decision, people. But yeah, and the other reason that people were willing to go see the movie, not our audience, but people in general, were because it got really good reviews, or at least in the Rotten Tomatoes binary world that we live in, it got a 74%. And this is something that I've noticed people start like putting outside of theaters. They'll have a chalkboard being like, this week, and it's like Shape of Water, 95% type of thing. Because I don't know where people's cutoff is for this percentage, but it's evidently how people are making decisions based on this Rotten Tomato meter.
Yeah, it's a Robert Parker wine rating. It's either, you know, it gets a 78 or it gets a 94, and that's how you make a judgment on your entertainment, I guess, now.
And so, like, but it's, you know, it's always, there are, of course, different types of movies that are going to be getting similar ratings. So, like, you know, the Fast and Furious movies, like we talked about before, probably get okay things because people are like, oh, well, these are just the epitome of a summer explosion movie. So it doesn't really, you could see Shape of Water 90% and this movie 74%. You're like, so it's 16 better? What does that even mean in right. my, how am I? But so I was curious about this because this didn't seem like a movie that 74% of critics should have left the theater being like, yep, thumbs up, like everyone would enjoy this. So I looked up some of the, I went into the reviews, which I'm sure that, you know, 1% of people actually go to Rotten Tomatoes do. They have blurbs, but then you can click through to the full review, obviously. And so during the live show, I gave you these pull quotes from these reviews and made you guess whether this was from a review that was deemed fresh, like 74% of them were, or rotten, 26%.
Right. And quite honestly, people out there, I won't actually remember which were which, but I won't play. So you play, but I would be cheating because I might remember as I hear them.
Yeah. So I'll just read them and then you can take a second to think about whether this was from a review deemed positive or negative. Here's one from the Malibu Times. I'm not the target audience. It went on too long and sagged somewhat in the second half.
That sounds, I mean, if I were a guessing man, I'd say that was rotten.
That is from a fresh review from the Malibu Times. So that second statement is questionable for a movie that you're going to give the positive green light to. But what do I know? We'll see if that replicates itself. Here's one from the Christian Science Monitor's critic. The love story and the message derived from it, that in our cyber age, we desperately need to spend more time in the real world, doesn't resonate because Spielberg is much better here at virtual reality than reality. And also because the real life characters have no more emotional heft than video game figures.
Well, first of all, I'm going to dispute the fact that the message is that in our cyber age, we desperately need to spend more time in the real world, given that he ends up spending most of his time in the virtual world anyway. But that does sound like a negative review, of course.
And that's another fresh review. So when you're seeing these tomato meter readings, maybe it helps to read them. Here's another one. BuzzFeed. Does Ready Player One know that it's a dark story recounted with oblivious lightness? In the same way that someone might tell you what they think is a funny anecdote about a wild night out, but that sounds more like a description of alcoholism? It's fair to say that the source material, a best-selling novel written by Ernest Cline, does not. It shows occasional glimpses of self-awareness that feel like the equivalent of watching someone's fixed smile slipping.
Wow, that doesn't sound good.
Oh, that doesn't sound good. And that is, in fact, a rotten review.
Weird bit of detail about if I were the friend of this.
Yes, exactly.
The author of this, like, wait a minute. Do you think I'm an alcoholic?
it's definitely projecting on themselves or someone that they know very well.
I was just describing, I went to a bar and then out of nowhere, like one of my favorite bands, you know, I know one of the guys who plays bass. And so I stayed till 2. I'm not an alcoholic.
I slapped a police horse. So what? Here's the fourth one. It's from moviecrypt.com. Even if you don't know what everything is, it's pretty to look at, but doesn't try to rise above a video game level of realism. As a late March release, reaching for a few bucks between Black Panther and Avengers Infinity War, this is a good excuse to waste a few hours on a weekend.
Oh, boy.
High praise from that fresh review.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So this is another, we've complained often about the why do you have to criticize it? Just turn off your brain and enjoy it kind of thing. Sure. This is another attempt at that, trying to come in on a more, you know, as a thing between this and this. You know, look, if you're going to have a good sandwich
And then you're going to have a dessert that you enjoy. Between it, right. Why not ram some filthy shit into your face?
It really is. It's like, well, we don't have to take that into account, whether or not when in March this is being released and what that means from a studio's bottom line expectations. That's not something that any right-thinking person should think about when they're evaluating the quality of a movie.
And what a weird sentence. This is a good excuse to waste a few I mean, yeah. I can think of many better if you're talking about wasting it. Why not? Why is the premise be that we have to waste the hours?
Right, exactly. Oh, well, this was, I think, ours and the audience's favorite. Because so not only do you have to question the very premise of Rotten Tomatoes, but you have to sort of be like, and who are they letting review movies on here again? Because this one is from the Laramie Movie Scope. A site that appears to be, I mean, not a joke, either written in Notepad or like GeoCities. It has a overflowing popcorn tub GIF at the top of it.
And then a
letter being like folded up and then turned over to say email and disappearing GIF on the bottom of the page.
Is this a Tim and Eric creation?
It could be. But I'm not sure where Laramie is. But anyway, the review. Maybe this movie appeals to gamers. It certainly seemed aimed at that audience. I am not a gamer, but it sure does appeal to me. I especially liked the way the film ended.
Oh my God.
So that's like an 85-year-old woman writing a letter to the editor type of review, but that counted towards the fresh rating. That one did.
Yes. What's the magazine insert the final
parade?
The people write in.
Yeah, exactly.
I enjoy the works of Charlene Tilton. What's she doing these days?
Yes, exactly. It is that person given a movie column. The final one is from the 7 Days, the Burlington, Vermont Alt Weekly. So it says, Wade and Samantha never rise above blandness. And their more interesting sidekicks have to fight for screen time. The film's villain, a CEO using his corporate army to game the contest, is goofy and incompetent, just like the authority figures in The Breakfast Club. That may be an aptly retro choice, but it lowers the stakes of the film, which eventually devolves into standard dystopian fighting the power action. Even if he wins, Wade is lost. He may know every line from 60-year-old cult flicks, but he lacks a living culture of his own. Only Rylance's awkward, regretful Halliday grounds the references in real life. As a result, he is the only character we connect to.
Well,
fresh.
No, yeah, come fresh. On.
It's, you know, that's that one's more just sort of ambivalent, being like, standard. We don't connect to anybody. But it's like, why is that considered praise?
I also don't understand. What is pulling in the Breakfast Club in there mean? They're not referenced in the film at all, are they?
No, I don't know. I mean,
there
I think
are plenty of other incompetent authority figures to go to without bringing up the Breakfast Club.
Right. I guess you can't really in good conscience compare him to Principal Rooney these days.
Yeah, well, that's right.
But that's sort of what I was saying. He's like I don't even know what a Spielberg example was. But yeah, that's sort of Terry Silver is your perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like a guy that we're supposed to, take at your word that he's established this billion-dollar empire. However, continually outsmarted and not ruthless enough to defeat a dumbass.
Yep. So I think we went through everything we want to do except for one thing. You have a particular obsession in this movie, and I'm fascinated by this because I do not. I do not know the reference, but I think we got to go through this.
Yeah, so like before I even saw it, I saw online it was popping up that among all the classic movie characters and pop culture licensed figures that were popping up in the movie, people were like surprising appearances from the Battletoads. And Battletoads is a Nintendo Entertainment System game that came out when I was in fourth grade, so in the wheelhouse for a pretty bad Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles ripoff. They're extreme toads who have Tood and they kick butt. Their names are Rash, Pimple, and Zitz.
And who are they fighting? Who are their archenemies in the,
they're
in
fighting,
the game?
They're fighting a woman who – well, they fight like some big rats And then there are crows. And then there's like a woman who sort of looks like Elvira, who is like on a spaceship that looks like a big bird of prey. I don't know her name. It's an extremely difficult game. So I've never really gotten past the if you're listening to this, I've never gotten past the level that you're thinking of.
And that is famously one of the things that it's a difficult game.
Very difficult game. And, you know, it's fun. It's stupid. It's fun to say Battletoads. I once had the pause music was my ringtone. And at some point in time, I was standing in line at a liquor store. My phone went off and it was playing the Battletoads pause music, which is recognizable. It goes, booch, 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 booch. And so a guy in line behind me, as I'm fumbling with my phone, sort of gives me a knowing nod, which was a very proud moment. It made all those years of having it worthwhile.
Can I say about that anecdote? That anecdote about a wild night out sounds more like the description of alcoholism. You're standing in line at a liquor store, getting a nod for someone else who was Battletoads.
Dad Boner then went out drinking with that guy and they fell asleep in his car. So I was happy about that. And I, you know, like I said, I was keeping an eye out for them during the first screening of the movie. And they show up maybe three times, just sort of hanging out at the dance club. They're in the final battle, sort of running towards the screen. If I had not been looking for them, I don't know if I would have known that they were the Battletoads, because they're sort of just a big green thing.
Yeah, after you pointed it out, I saw them in the second viewing, and I thought, it looks like Diggum from Sugar Pops or whatever, or it didn't register with me at all. They're not very attractive. They're also not very distinctive in a way either. So
yeah. They've got that sort of how the Ninja Turtles look in their most recent movies, that sort of just bland CGI thing, minus, you know, take away the cartooniness or the 8-bitness, and they don't have much to offer. But right. The point of this is, since I was thinking Battletoads, I went out and I sort of looked up what how this came to be. And it turned out that they had a long history with Spielberg he was always trying to get them into his movies. And
this
was just like the final payoff. Yeah. They had known each other for a long time. They were sort of, they didn't go to USC with him and Lucas, but they were like the townies that when they went out drinking at the bars, they would always be like running into the Battletoads. And at some point in time, it was like, listen, man, like we've seen each other at this bar, like, 36 times, and we should introduce each other. And they hit it off. And so Spielberg was like, had a few. So he was like, yeah, you guys are great. Like Rash, Pimple, Zits, I'm getting you into a movie.
What's his name with like McConaughey and Affleck. These are guys who were sort of around, weren't necessarily professional actors, but they were characters and they wanted to. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And they were sort of coming up together. Like they would do odd jobs like carpentry on movie sets. So they were part of the scene, but like, he was like, I see something in you, sort of like Harrison Ford. He's like, I want to get you in front of the camera. People need to see this. But he was he was talking it up. He was like, listen, I've got this film I'm working on, Duel. Like I don't have any cred in Hollywood right now. But I really feel good things about this. It's going to hit.
And that was within the studio system. When he was doing Duel, he basically had to, you know, you're going to use Dennis Weaver because he's under contract. You have to use him. It would be rare for a director to be able to say, I've got these guys, you know, the Battletoads. And they're great. They'd be great for it. But and I think even the studio their hands were tied, because it's like, we are tied down to our own system. We can't go outside, you know.
Right. So, but Spielberg was like, I have faith in myself that I'm going to be able to make it big to the point where I'm able to call my own shots. And he made that happen. He made Jaws, and they were like, well, that's it. Like, I've just printed my ticket. I couldn't get you guys in the movie. I wanted to have you, being the guys throwing the stick for the dog.
Oh yeah. In the famous. Yeah.
And he wanted to cash Pimple as like the old guy when the widow, the boy's mom comes up and she's wearing the black veil.
Oh yeah, striking.
She's sort of escorted by this old guy,
right?
And it's like, is that her dad? Is that her husband? I can't really tell how old she's supposed to be. But so he wanted Pimple to play that part. didn't work out because this was sort of, like I said, the way they're going to make this happen.
Yeah. But I mean, Jaws, I think even at this time, as you told me, which I found fascinating, is that Spielberg famously, he snuck onto the lot of Universal and basically started working there, and no one thought, who is this guy? They just were like, oh, this very enthusiastic, very talented guy is just here, and he must work here. And he made his way in, and so he did Jaws. And now, all of a sudden, they went, wait, this guy never even worked for us. This is amazing. So this amazing story. So the Battletoads were then like, all right, here we go.
It's going to happen. Yeah. But then he came to them, and he's like, I got it. You know, it's approved. You've got three major lead roles in 1941.
Right.
And like, they were sort of like, the
script,
I don't know, man.
The script just did not excite.
We appreciate it.
Right.
You know, but like, you know, it doesn't, we don't want to say anything because we know you're enthusiastic about it. But like, yeah, we knew from the start that one was not going to work out. So they like made up excuses about like, they said that Zitt's father was ailing. So they had to sort of go and tend to him. And then the movie flopped, and they were aware that was going to happen. So they didn't want that to be their, you know, you show up in a flop like 1941, that might be your only shot.
It is amazing. There are some people like that, like the Battletoads, who know themselves so well, even though they don't know the industry, they weren't inside the industry, but to know, to be so confident in your own abilities and everything, to say, no, I'm not going to do this film. The script did not excite me. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't speak to a part of me. That is confidence.
Yeah. And they say that like one of the most important self-care things you can do is not saying yes to everything. So I think that's, you know, that's a testament to their mindset. That eventually led to their success. But they, Steven Spielberg came back and he offered them up prime roles in E.T., which they were thrilled by.
Oh, wow. I did not know that part of it.
Yeah, they were like, on board, we'll do it. Thank you so much for crafting this role for us. I mean, you know, BT is going to be a great movie. You know, most people don't know Battletoads, but once they see a movie BT that stands for Battletoads, that's going to make us household names.
Where a little kid finds BT's. In his equipment shed. This is a perfect fit.
And so Steven Spielberg was on the phone, like a payphone. The connection wasn't very good, so he sort of had to awkwardly let him know that they had misheard him, that it was E.T., that it was not B.T. And so that was not received well.
That was a dark period, and that was their rift, right? Didn't you tell me they became estranged for a short while there?
Yeah, they didn't really talk during that. I mean, it was a misunderstanding, but it's, you know, you could understand when it's like a prank. You know, you get all these hopes up, you see all these possibilities, and then it didn't happen. Pimple took it especially hard. He really hit the skids.
This is difficult. Go ahead and tell me.
Yeah, he Spielberg. Well, he offered them a role in Schindler's List. And it was coincidentally the same day that Pimple was taken off life support in the hospital.
Oh my God. Oh.
It was devastating. And the other two guys, Rash and Zitz, they were going to do it for his memory, you know?
Yeah. But it's pretty fresh. I mean,
they knew it was what he would want though, to do this, powerful story. And so Steven Spielberg was like, yeah, it's a black and white movie. It's the horrors of the Holocaust, but there is going to be one scene, where there is a shot of a character in color, and you guys being green and yellow, will really pop when I do that. And, but then the studio said, what the hell are you thinking? This is a Holocaust movie and you cannot put the Battletoads in your, solemn Holocaust movie.
Yeah, so that was more, it wasn't about his own power and ability at that time. It was like the subject matter, come on. I mean, you're bowing to many, many forces here. And so it's understandable. It's you know, tragic for the relationship between Spielberg and the Battletoads, but it is, it's completely understandable.
Yeah, at this point in time, they were starting to wonder if maybe he was just sort of all talk. The next movie he offered them was Amistad, and he was going to... he was going to make some changes to it. He was going to call it Amistad.
I didn't know that.
And that was the sort of thing where they were like, what on earth are you talking about, man? Get your act together. No one's going to see a movie about a slave revolt called Amistad. If the, all the slaves are played by Battletoads, this is not going to happen. I mean, so they were offended by that. I mean, as you should be. That's a terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea, and you can't buck the source material like that. This is a beloved, you know, the incident and the book about it are beloved, and obviously you can't mess with that.
Yeah, it's a powerful, powerful movie. And so the two of those in a row, when Steven Spielberg called with Munich, they were like, fine, we'll take it, whatever. And then he called back 30 minutes later, and they were like, oh, let us guess. Like, you can't make a movie about the racist assassination of Israeli Olympic athletes with Battletoads in it, because that's wildly offensive.
I assume that's what it was, right?
No, it was because Eric Bana said that he doesn't work with toads.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that's, you know, that's its own issue.
Yeah, he had his...
That's its own thing.
He had his own juice. He's Australian, right? So just, yeah, who knows? Maybe that's an Australian thing.
They did devastate the crops, at least in The Simpsons. I've been led to believe that. So that, you know, maybe that's understandable.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yep.
Maybe a Battletoad, you know, stole his wife like Halliday did. I'm not sure how that happens. But then he came back a few years later. He offered them a role in Adventures of Tintin, that adaptation.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. That's animated and, yeah. And yeah. They're obviously real life characters. I don't know how they would do that. What are they going to put the mocap suit on them, or how are they?
Yeah,
do
I guess
that?
They were going to, but they were like, no, those like the hollow eyes in those movies really creep us out. Like the Uncanny Valley is not something the Toads were down with.
Right.
So they were just like, they're
so
like,
they turned it down.
Yeah. They were unhappy with that being their debut as well. They thought that might be sort of just like, not how they wanted audiences to have their first on-screen impression of them.
Right. Well, once again, know yourself. This is good. I mean, and this is a long stretch of movies that we've covered here. So to still have that confidence, like when we do this, we're going to do it right. Steven Spielberg, biggest director in Hollywood. I admire that. I admire that steely core that the Battletoads seem to have.
It's integrity. I mean, when you really want to focus on it. And it's just so rare. Happy story, happy ending.
Yeah.
He calls with Ready Player One, and they like are like, oh, yeah, obviously, and we'll do it. Best part of all, Pimple's son is a dead ringer for him. He's an actor. We would love it if he could play his father in this role, sort of like Ice Cube's son played Ice Cube in
the
movie. So they were like, this is wonderful. We loved the book. We're big Klein heads. We didn't like Armada. But, you know, we'll have that conversation after the shoot. So then he cast them in Ready Player One. They showed up. They delighted crowds. And I think they were going to see big things from Battletoads in some future Steven Spielberg movies.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And did you see them on the red carpet? Wasn't that was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. They were
because, frankly, once you put a... You know, you put a suit on them. I think they were wearing some colorful tuxes to show that they were, you know, like, we're not actually establishment Hollywood kind of stuff.
Right.
But really, I don't mean to be mean to the lead actor in Ready Player One, but much more attractive than him.
More charismatic. They, you know, they had their one-liners. You could tell they'd prepared them, but they were pointing the finger guns and cracking everybody up.
They have a chemistry that goes back a while. It was like when, you know, the Beatles show up in the United States. I just seen Can't Buy Me Love. Is that no? What's their first movie?
Hard Day's Night.
Hard Day's Night. And they show up and they recreate that famous press conference where, like, how can these young people? How do they have so much chemistry? They've been working together for years, like the Battletoads. So they have this immediate chemistry and charisma that it was a lot of fun to see.
And that's the story of how the Battletoads ended up in the Ready Player One film adaptation. It is a hard thing to convey the thud that the line Amistad landed in front of a live crowd consisting.
Oh, I think they can imagine that.
Who didn't see the movie? Who didn't know what I was talking about? But still managed to be offended by that.
Some of the groans were delightful, but lost to history.
Thank you for indulging me with another, I'd say even twice as long read through.
I think a good three times as long. All right. Well, there we go.
That's it. You know, and I just hope that recorded. Hope that recorded.
I'm looking at the waveform right now, so I think it is. And, you know, we're still, I think it's going to be TBD with the letting our detractors hammer on us. But we'll probably put one up. We can't say when. That's just, you know, it's out there. It could happen soon or it could happen, you know, a couple weeks. Who knows?
All right. Yeah. So keep an eye out for that. But thank you for encouraging us to get this done, even though the live one didn't work. Because, yeah, it would have been a bummer not to talk about this, even if it did happen a couple weeks after the peak of this movie's popularity.
That's right. And who knows? Maybe we'll be back with another. We have to look for a book that has exactly 372 pages. But
That's the only criteria.
Yes. So if you have any suggestions, please send them our way. And thank you once again for going through this with us. And we'll see you soon.
Talk to you later. Bye.